All right, it's 8 o'clock. Let's have an AA meeting. Hi, my name is Chris Ward. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the Napa Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our own personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org desperately in need will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, "Yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing." And tonight, Mike is going to come up and introduce our speaker. So at this, I'll give it over to Mike.
My name's Mike. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
I didn't know I'd be here tonight. That's the effect that Jim has on me. I've known Jim for a couple of years, and he's been instrumental as far as my sobriety. Always seems to have a good word to say regarding the program. Works a good program. And when he said he was coming down here tonight, we met at another meeting tonight. And I said, I wouldn't miss it for the world. So anyway, here's Jim.
Good evening. I'm Jim, an alcoholic.
Hi, Jim.
And thank you, Mike. Tim, Chris, thanks for your service. And thanks to the readers. It's funny, when Tim called me, I guess it was a few weeks ago, asked if I would speak, he'd left a voice message on my cell phone. And I didn't call right back. I called my sponsor. And I told my sponsor, I said, to be perfectly honest, I really don't want to do this. And it's not because I haven't done it. I've been blessed with having been in these rooms for many, many years, which I will share. But to be honest, I'm not in a particularly great space in my life. And I haven't shared much at meetings for a long time. You know, we read the promise here. You know, our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Mine has not been particularly great. In fact, it borderline sucks. But, you know, my sponsor says, I mean, I got to get up here and I got to tell the truth. I got to tell you, you know, what's going on. And as I, you know, share my story, and there's a lot of it to try and share in a short time, you know, maybe you'll get an idea. I mean, the first thing I'm not real happy about was Friday I turned 65. And it was funny, I was talking to my daughter yesterday. She had called. She did me proud. I'm a child of the late 60s and early 70s, and she went to D.C. to march. And did me proud because 45 years ago, I did the same thing at Nixon's second inauguration. But I told her, I just said, this is a rough one. 30 wasn't a lot of fun. 60 wasn't a lot of fun. And 65 just totally sucked. But that's what it is, you know. And so it was 65 years ago Friday. I came to the world in Fort Worth, Texas. Was there about a year, and moved to Chicago. That's where I spent most of my life, was in the Chicago area. Although there's a lot of geographical in my story, and I don't want to dwell on my childhood too much. I mean, there's some stuff I'm very fond of. My mother grew up on a farm in West Central Illinois, so I spent a lot of time as a kid on the farm. Just had a great time there, very peaceful place. But went through some tough times. My folks got divorced when I was like 9 years old. My mother tried to commit suicide. They ended up getting back together when I was like 11. But it was never a particularly happy household. You know, that's what it is. I mean, I don't know too many people in my life that I've run across that have had the White House with the picket fence story, you know. I think we've all had some challenges in our lives, whether we're alcoholic or not. I was fortunate enough. It was, you know, pretty much very much a middle class upbringing. Never really wanted for much. Don't ever remember going hungry. You know, always had a roof over our heads. Dad worked hard. Mom worked. Went to high school. I think started in 66. I graduated in 70. I pretty much hated high school. It was one of those things. I don't know if your high school was like this. It was very cliquish. You know, there was the biker bunch, and then there were the hippies, and then there were the jocks, and the intellectuals, and I never really connected with any of them. I mean, yeah, I was an athlete. I played on a lot of teams, and it just didn't do much for me. Went to the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. Entered there in 1970, and what heady times those were. I thoroughly loved my time in college. It was great. I mean, there will be drugs in my story. You can't tell by the time that I grew up. I didn't really do much drinking in high school. Didn't drink all that much my first few years in college. Smoked a lot of dope. Smoked a lot of reefer. Dropped a little bit of acid. Did some lewds. Did all that stuff. But I think sophomore, junior year, the drinking started picking up. But it was never an issue. At that age, the hangovers went away very, very quickly. We all did it. It was just the people I hung out with. That's what we did. But those were great times. Going to class barefooted, and playing frisbee on the quad with the dogs, and all that stuff. It was fun times. Graduated. This is funny. I graduated. I took the easier, softer way. I wish I could do it over, but I took the easier, softer way, and I ended up with a degree in psych. My major was activity therapy. And what I ended up doing, I got a job at Northwestern Memorial Hospital Institute of Psychiatry in Chicago. And I was a therapist on a locked ward. And I did this for about 9 months. And what's so crazy about it is that there were a fair number of alcoholics that I worked with. I would go home from that job at night and get high and get drunk, and did that pretty much every night, and then come back to work and try and help people, which was pretty bizarre. But it only lasted about a year. I just said, this is not for me, and so I left, and I ended up getting a job in an industry that I stayed in for almost 30 years, the consumer electronics industry, and I was fixing record changers. And those of you are old enough to remember, the thing you just stack the records on and it would go down, and the mechanical things. And it was, it was okay. But one thing led to another, and I ended up moving to Connecticut. Mike and I have shared a little bit of our New England stories. But I was in Connecticut from 77 to 82, and it was interesting. I went there as their customer service manager. It was the northwest corner of Connecticut, the Berkshire Mountains. I don't know if anybody is familiar with it. Route 7, Housatonic Valley. Really God's country in many ways. But got myself a nice little three-bedroom cabin. And what a great place for an alcoholic to isolate. It was just wonderful. I had a few friends. We played a lot of music together, but it was there in Connecticut that my drinking started taking a real serious, it just got to a very serious level, and they'd given me this job. Through all this, I'd always done pretty well in my work, and they'd given me an opportunity to be a regional sales manager with the company, and even though the company was based in Connecticut, they gave me, because I always kind of loved the West, they gave me the West Coast, and I didn't move to the West Coast. I traveled pretty regularly out there, and my weeks consisted of a week in Seattle, back home for a week in L.A., back home for a week in San Francisco, back home for a week. The one thing about being a traveling salesperson, and I don't know if there are people in sales here or not, you spend a lot of time in hotel rooms alone. And invariably, the routine was I would, on the way to the hotel, would stop, get a 12-pack of beer, 6-pack of beer, whatever. It's so long ago now. I think it started as a 6-pack of beer and maybe a pint of Jack Daniels, And I'd check into the room and fill up the sink with ice, and in went the beers, and you know, I'd sit there with a guitar and watch TV, and you know, that was my life, you know, for like a couple of years. But that job ended, and then the company went through some changes, and they brought me back east, and I ended up having some serious trouble. I realized for a lot of years that I didn't drink like most of my friends. I recognized that I drank a lot more. But it was when I was in Connecticut, and this was like I said, around 1979, 80, I really started losing all control. You know, like it talks about in the book, in We Agnostics. It's like, you know, when people ask, well, how do I know if I'm an alcoholic? Well, I was one of those that once I started drinking, I had little control over the amount that I drank. And I had a very hard time stopping. It's just that, you know, early on, it didn't take as much for me to pass out. I mean, that's the, you know, the bottom line. But as I built up tolerance, it took more and more and more. And I ended up in the hospital for the first time. In fact, I went to the hospital several times while I was in Connecticut. And the routine was I had this girl who would... I had a dog through all this. I had this dog since college, by the way. So by the time I got to Connecticut, you know. But the dog's name was Arrow. It was me and my Arrow. And I had a dog sitter. So whenever I traveled, the dog sitter, you know, would come on and take care of Arrow. And what happened was, I think it was like the... It was in a course of like 6 months. I was calling. I couldn't. I mean, I get to the point where I was so weak, I could barely get out of bed because all I did was just drink nonstop. And I would call the ambulance service, and the ambulance guys would show up at the door. The next call would be to the dog sitter. And I think it was like the third time these ambulance guys showed up. It's like they knew the dog's name, they knew the sitter's phone number. I mean, it was you know, it was ridiculous. And but yet I was not, you know, I was not convinced that I was an alcoholic at that point. I remember my first contact with anybody from Alcoholics Anonymous was a very dignified gray-haired woman that came to the hospital in Sharon, Connecticut. I remember that. And I distinctly remember her sitting by my bedside with the big book. You know, and but I wasn't ready to hear anything she had to say. I just wasn't done yet. So things didn't get any better. And then word got back to my parents in Chicago of what I was going through. And my father came out for a visit, tried to get me straightened out. He went back. That didn't work. And then my mother actually came out, and they dragged me back to Chicago. And at that point, I was 30 years old. And that was pretty demoralizing, to be 30 years old and, you know, have your parents drag you back home. But I went back home. I got straightened out as best I could get straightened out. Ended up getting an apartment. Got a job as a national sales manager for a company. And within 6 months, I was back in the hospital again. And this happened at least... I lost track of how many times I was in and out of hospitals. That was my thing. When I get to the point that I was just toast, I'd go to the hospital because I knew they could straighten me out. You know? I went through a 28-day program. I remember that. I didn't make it through the 28 days. The last weekend, they gave you the weekend off, and I chose to go home and ride my motorcycle. And I swore up and down to my therapist the whole time. I said, "Look, I realize I got a problem with alcohol, but marijuana was never a problem, you know." And I went home, rode my motorcycle, got stoned, went back Sunday night. Therapist looked at me. I was never a good liar. He says, "You got stoned, didn't you?" I said, "Yeah." So they kicked me out of 28-day program. Put me on antabuse. If any of those of you know what antabuse is, but if you drink while you're taking antabuse, you get very, very sick. I did. You know, it's been said many, many times, it took what it took for me to hit a bottom. And I think that last time I walked out of the hospital, I remember I went back home, and this was like two more trips to hospitals after the 28-day program. I It was interesting. The last hospital I went to was only two blocks from my apartment. So I didn't have to call ambulances anymore. I didn't even have to call a cab. I mean, I could literally crawl to the hospital from the apartment. But it's funny. I had this job. It started with this company, another consumer electronics company, in 1984. And it was in March that I got the job. And I had sobered up enough and stayed, you know, reasonably under control, you know, for a couple months before I ended up back in the hospital again. And I was so concerned because I liked the job, and I was so concerned that what they were going to tell them. And the doctor said, I'm trying to remember what the diagnosis was. Oh, it was toxic brain syndrome. Didn't call me an alcoholic. I had toxic brain syndrome. I didn't want the insurance to know or something, but I walked out of the hospital that time, and I went home to my apartment, and I don't think I went to a meeting that night. I went to work the next day. I came home, and, you know, I still was swearing up and down that marijuana was a problem, so I had this bong, and I didn't have any marijuana left, but I cleaned the bong, and I took all the resin I could find in it, and, yep, been there, done it. And I got good and stoned that night from, you know, the residue of my bong. But the next night, there was a 5:40 meeting. There are mustard seeds all over the U.S., but there is a mustard seed in Chicago. And I was living near North Side. Anybody that knows Chicago's in the Lincoln Park area. I went to the mustard seed for a 5:45 meeting, and that was September 17th, 1984. And I just knew I was home when I went in there. It was an old brownstone. I remember you went up. It was up on the second floor. It was a room about the half the size of this with a big old stone fireplace. And the first speaker I remember hearing was this Jamaican dude. His name was Jimmy. And I remember hearing him sharing about, we come from all walks of life. And, you know, Park Place, Park Bench, jail and Yale and all this stuff, and I connected, and it was strongly suggested that I go to 90 meetings in 90 days, and I did. I did a lot more than that. I fell in love with the mustard seed, and I fell in love with you people, because by the time I had gotten there, alcohol had just bludgeoned me almost to death. And I stand here tonight and can honestly tell you that I absolutely do believe that if it weren't for Alcoholics Anonymous, I would be dead. I would absolutely be dead. I will never forget that first year of sobriety in Chicago. It was just amazing. It was amazing. I did the 99. I got a sponsor. The first sponsor I got was living in his car. I didn't know that at the time. But he told me, he said, Jim, you might want to, you know, I'll be your temporary sponsor, but you might want to, you know, think about getting somebody else. So, and I did. And at the time, I think Eli was his name. He had like 3 or 4 years, but he was a very gentle man. I was never one of these people that needed AA shoved down my throat. I needed somebody who was going to be gentle with me because I felt like crap. I mean, I was the lowest scum of the earth, you know, at that point. My self-esteem couldn't be any lower. And so Eli immediately got me into reading the book, and we immediately started working the steps. And it was, I probably averaged it was like a step a month with him. Did my first fourth step. I vividly remember that. He lived a few blocks north of me, closer to Wrigley Field. And I remember going to his apartment, and I still remember that dingy, grayish-green shag carpeting he had. You know, I remember the shag carpeting, you know, from it was popular in the 70s or whatever. But I remember we got on our knees and prayed. And then I did my fifth step with him. And I had walked up there, and I walked home. And it was probably about a good mile walk back to my apartment. And I just remember, like, I felt like I was floating in air that night after sharing that story with him. And the friendships that I developed in that first year. And some of the things I did were just so cool. They had something, I don't know if they still do it in Chicago, but it was something that was kind of like the Atlanta Roundup, but they called it the All Chicago Open. and they took this big, it was like the Chicago Amphitheater or something, that they would have this thing every year, and there was like 6,000-7,000 recovering alcoholics at this thing. And I went with some friends from Mustard Seed, and to show you how there's got to, I mean, I'll get into to my understanding, the God of my understanding as I move here, as I see I need to get moving, I was at this amphitheater full of 6,000 people, and who do I run into but the therapist from the 28-day program. And at that point I had just passed my 1-year birthday, and it was so, it was really cool. It was just a very, very cool spiritual thing. The company I was with gave me an opportunity to move on with them, and the opportunity was in South Florida. And it was spring of 86. I was a year and a half sober. I moved from Chicago to South Florida. And I immediately hooked in with friends in the program. They showed the great spirit, higher power working in my life. I rented a house, and right across the street there were three people that were soon to become very, very good AA buddies. Hooked up through my years in AA, and I've done things like play, you know, AA softball teams a lot. I remember my first, backtrack a little bit, one of the coolest things I did was my first New Year's sober in Chicago. I went to a AA roller skating party, which was pretty cool. Just interesting seeing a bunch of sober drunks on roller skates on New Year's Eve. Things in Florida, it was interesting what happened in Florida. The job was cool. I mean, I was a regional manager down there. But within about a year of being there, I was probably there 6 months, I met the lady that was ultimately to become my wife. And she was in the program. And we did the quote-unquote AA dating thing. But what attracted me to her was she just struck me as being extremely spiritual, and she still is today. We're still married, amazingly, sometimes. That was, what is that now? It's coming up. It was June of 87 that we got married. 9 months later, my daughter was born. Right about that time, I bought my first house. And I was, what was I? I was not even three, I was 3 years sober. I wasn't ready for that. I mean, the one thing that I recognize today is that all the alcohol and all the drugs, as the book tells it, those really weren't the problem. They really weren't the problem. They were always my solution. And as the book says, I mean, my problem even to this day is my self-centeredness. And that, those first few years of being married and being a new father and whatever were very, very challenging for me, because my self-centeredness was still, it was very strong still. You know, we made it through. I continued to do well at my work, ultimately, and after 8 years down there, they moved us to Atlanta. And I ultimately ended up, still to this day, I can't believe they did it, but they made me a vice president. I had arrived. You know, I was a VP. It's like, I still am amazed. There's this thing called the Peter Principle. I don't know if you've heard of it, where people rise to their highest level of competence and you don't go any further. I went way over that. Because I'm back down to where I think I probably should be. Now, things were incredible. I mean, it just rolled along, and I was traveling all over the world, and I'd been to Japan, and Taiwan, and Hong Kong, and Singapore, and was in charge of 13 states, and, you know, 60 million, or 300 million a year in sales, and all, you know, all this kind of stuff. And then they decided, along about 2003, that the company wasn't doing particularly well, and they let a whole bunch of middle management go, of which I was one of them. So I struck out on my own. I've always had a love of music, and so I became an independent musical instrument rep. And it was a little insane thinking I could service the Four Corners states out in the Rockies from Atlanta, but I did. and I was putting 2,000 to 5,000 miles a month on the car, going back and forth. But along about that time, high quality problem, we had a pontoon boat that we kept up at Lake Lanier. And I was one weekend scrubbing the bottom of the pontoons, and I felt something pop in my shoulder. And I was in a lot of pain, and so I went and had it checked out. Sure enough, I needed to have shoulder surgery. So I went and got the shoulder surgery, and of course, they prescribed pain medication. And I really, really liked the effect produced by opiates. I've never really had any experience with it, but I pretty much got hooked on them. And you know, I talk about the delusion of this disease. I convinced myself that I deserved to take these things because I was in constant pain. And so for about from 2003 to 2005, there were a couple times I kind of got over the edge a little bit and where I could kind of feel I was going through withdrawals a little bit. And I went through one particularly bad stretch. It was about after about 2 years. And I kept going to meetings, by the way, all this time, you know, claiming that I was still sober. I went to a meeting. I had been on the pain meds pretty heavy for about a week. And the most I ever took in a day was, I don't know, maybe 12, 14 pills, which to some people, that's a lot, obviously. But I've heard of people taking 50 or something. But anyways. But I had gotten to that point, so trying to cold turkey when you're doing that amount, it wasn't fun. And I went to a meeting at Easy 123. My sponsor at the time was there, and I left that meeting. And I was shaken. I was hurting pretty bad. And it talks about it in the big book. The thought of a drink entered my mind, and it didn't leave my mind. And before I got home that night, I had stopped at a liquor store in Flowery Branch, where I live, and bought a half a pint of Jack Daniels. Jack was always one of my favorite hard drinks. And I went home and I drank it. And it felt really weird, because at that point it had been 22 and a half years since I put alcohol in my body. And the numbing effect, I didn't really like the effect produced by it. You know, it was too strange. But I was done. I was done for at that point. I woke up the next morning. I had my own company at the time, but I stopped. I came. I think I went online to find out when the first liquor store opened, and there was one up in Oakwood or something. It opened at 8 o'clock, and I went there and I bought a pint of vodka. Folks, I never drank vodka ever. You know, but people said they can't smell it. You know, yeah, right. I drank half a bottle of vodka before I went to work. Went to work, pronounced to my employees that I don't feel well. I'm going to go home. Went home, finished that bottle. Told my wife, apparently she didn't realize I was drunk, went to bed. I came to, and I was mad at that point. I was mad. The total craving was in. It was kicked in. Probably in a blackout, I remember going to the liquor store, buying another pint of vodka, and I was going to do what I used to always do. I was going to go to Northeast Georgia Medical Center and get myself checked in. I never made it to Northeast Georgia Medical Center. I woke up in the back of a Hall County squad car. I went to spent the night in jail, called my wife. She came the next morning to get me. She says, "How long have you been drinking?" 11 hours? You know? I mean, it says it in the book. You know, it progresses, even when we're not drinking. You know? I walked out of jail, I went home, I took a shower. I'd never want to go to jail again. It's the worst ever. And I did. I had to sort out the rest of my time. But I went straight to the Serenity House in Buford, picked up a white chip. Now, interestingly enough, when I first got sober in 1984, they didn't give out chips at the mustard seed. You know, they gave out medallions, but they didn't give out chips. So I picked up a white chip. I immediately I hooked right in. I called my sponsor. I've been sober since. It's about 9.5 years now. I start off by saying that I'm not in a real good place. I still have not totally recovered from that relapse. I don't really care for the job I have. I have issues with my relationship. But the bottom line is I don't want to drink. I don't want to die. I think about it sometimes, you know. But I'm very, very grateful to be a member of this program to be sober. I am what a lot of people, you know, say we're egomaniacs with inferiority complexes. That's me. I'm a legend in my own mind. That's me. I'm extremely self-conscious still. That's my self-centeredness. The book says it. That's the root of my trouble. As I said, the alcohol and the drugs were never the problem. It's my self-centeredness. The thing that I'm grateful for is that I'm aware of it today. Now, on the subject of God, I thought I believed in God. I grew up going to Sunday school. I'm grateful to my father for doing that. I never questioned that there wasn't a God. Everybody talked about God. I guess there's a God. And then I don't know that I ever really connected. In that first 22 and a half years, I do remember I had one sponsor in particular that really helped me with that. What I struggle with now is that there's a whole chapter for people like me in the book, We Agnostics. I can't say that there isn't a God, but I'm not absolutely convinced that there is. There are amazing things that happen in my life almost every day that I can't account for. So I'm willing. The book only says I have to be willing. You know, the book says I just need to be willing, and from there I can start. The God thing is still a real struggle for me. I don't know. Yeah, I still go to meetings regularly. I have a wonderful sponsor. As I said, I don't share much at meetings these days because, you know, we're taught to share our experience, strength, and hope. And it's my opinion, I abound in experience. I'm a little short on the strength and hope these days. But there's still some there. That's the whole story behind the mustard seed. The mustard seed, I may have it wrong, but it's a very, very tiny seed that grows into a huge plant. So I still have this much hope. I have no desire to drink. The obsession is long since been removed, but it can come back just like that. All I have to do is pick up one drink. I've proved that. People ask me, where do you think you really screwed up? Where I screwed up was, I went through a period of time when I was traveling out west that I didn't have a sponsor. And that's my experience, is that I will never, I hate the word never, but my intention is to never go without a sponsor again. Because I was not accountable to anybody. You know, God's going to, if there's a God, it's going to let me do what I want to do. You know, it's not going to stop me. So I talk to this sponsor regularly, and he's the one that hears what's going on in my heart. You folks in this room have heard more of what's in my heart tonight than most people in meetings do here lately. And that's because my sponsor told me to do it. As they said, other than, you know, if it weren't for him, I probably wouldn't be here. Sorry, Tim. I've said enough, I think. Alcoholics Anonymous is an absolutely amazing program. As I've already said, I'd be dead if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous. And even, as I said, I intend to never go without a sponsor. My intention is to never drink or use drugs again. I won't say never, because I did it. But if I do the work, which I continue to do, I think I got a pretty good shot. So. Thank you very, very much for listening.
Just another homesick child, tired of running wild, ready to stand trial and move on. Though I'm guilty in your sight, ask for mercy tonight. I can't make it through this fight all alone. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. But please, please, won't stress shining a light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt. Keep me out of the shadow of doubt. As I try to make some sense of this world I'm up against, well, I know my best defense is your love. When the struggle gets its day and the lessons fall of pain, keep me calling out your name with love. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. But please, please, won't you shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt. Keep me out of the shadow of doubt. From the bottom of my heart, and I'm searching for one star to shine. I will shout from mountain high, and I'll reach into the sky till you open up my eyes so blind. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. But please, please, won't you shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt. Keep me out of the shadow of doubt.